I've had my share. One of my mentors in ministry, Kent Hughes, relates his buying an old VW Bug back when he was first in ministry. And it was that, remember this? That lovely pea green color. All apologies to any of you who may have one, that color. But its paint had been dulled by the years, by dust and dirt, by all the salt coming off the ocean from where they lived. But it was a fairly reliable car, as they tended to be. But it was a very ugly car. And he decided to do something about it. He bought some polishing compounds and went to work. And with a lot of elbow grease, he was able to restore a lot of its original shine, pea green though it may be. But it took a lot of time, a lot of effort, a lot of work. God is doing something like this in our lives. God is at work to polish you. We get dulled spiritually by the dust of the world and exposure to sin and temptation. We need to be washed and polished and waxed so we will shine. This is what Genesis 21 is all about. The three events here are linked in that they are God's work of polishing and preparing Abraham. And yes, there are lots of other threads and themes. We'll talk about them. But I want you to sit up and take notice at how God is at work. God is preparing Abraham for the test of Genesis 22. And God is beginning to settle him in the land. And in order for him to do that, God's got his polished compound, and he's got his buffer out, and he's at work, shaping and molding. How do we tend to respond to times when, well, God gets out those things, his sandpaper, his polishing compound, his buffers? Well, you will sometimes question God and become perplexed. Now, this may not be wrong if you're moving towards God in your perplexity. But sometimes this questioning and perplexity just becomes another of a series of steps to move away from the Lord. You may resent what God is doing and become bitter. So many people have all these rub areas in their lives where God has been polishing and they have become resentful and bitter. You sometimes become angry and turn against those God is using. How many times are relationships broken because you will not accept the honing and shaping work of God from people? Are there these kinds of broken relationships in your own life? You may reject what God is doing and even come under his chastening. Sadly, there are lots of people who resist and reject what God is doing and then come under his severe but loving rod of correction. Sometimes we question God and become perplexed. Sometimes we resent what God is doing and become bitter. Sometimes we become angry and we turn against those that God is using. Sometimes we reject what God is doing and then it really gets hard. So how is Abraham going to respond through these three situations in which God is directly at work? Can you see God at work in your life to polish you? Now, the point here is not to give you tips on how to handle these three particular situations, because frankly, they're not here. The point here is to encourage you to take heart and have hope that God is at work in your life. These seemingly unrelated events are like lots of things in your life. What is God up to? What is God up to in the midst of personal blessing? Look down at your Bibles in verses 1 through 7 of chapter 21. What is God up to in the midst of personal blessing? The Lord visited Sarah as he had said, and the Lord did to Sarah as he had promised, and Sarah conceived and bore Abraham a son in his old age at the time of which God had spoken to him. Abraham called the name of the son who was born to him, whom Sarah bore to him, Isaac. Abraham circumcised his son Isaac when he was 8 days old, as God commanded him. Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born to him, and Sarah said, God has made laughter for me, or God has made Isaac for me, play on the word. And everyone who hears will Isaac over me, will laugh over me. And he said, and she said, Who would have said to Abraham that Sarah would nurse children? Yet I have borne him a son in his old age. You see, the first place where God is at work in polishing us is in the midst of personal blessing. Now, this might come as a surprise, but God is polishing and preparing us when things seem to be going really well. In verses 1 and 2, we see God's direct intervention. This is a very great high place in Genesis. Here is the culmination of a grand promise, a great faith, and a long patience. Yet it is written with almost stark understatement. God did, at this point, what he said, and she became pregnant. And this understatement's a bit startling, because you really think big hoopla and big points and big exclamations and lots of words and hip hip hurrah, but it's this sort of almost studied understatement grabs our attention. In two short sentences, Abraham and Sarah at 190 become parents. When it was impossible physically, God directly intervened so that Sarah conceived and bore a child. And let's not miss the connection to Jesus' own birth. He was the promised Messiah. He came just at the time of God's ordination, like Isaac. He was born in a way that was naturally and physically impossible, like Isaac. And like Sarah, Mary conceived through a miracle. Sarah's conception was a miracle of regeneration where her physical deadness was overcome. Mary's was a miracle of conception, where the Spirit of God begat in her womb the Lord Jesus in what we call the mysterious union of the Incarnation. It's God's direct intervention. And so here is this marvelous, wonderful, amazing moment in Abraham and Sarah's life, and it is a great and glorious blessing. God's got his polishing compound and his buffer, and he's got his sandpaper out, and he's got his chisels out, and God is at work. Because in the midst of personal blessing, one of the things that's highlighted in verses 3 and 4 is Abraham's practical obedience. Abraham called the name of his son who was born to him, Isaac, and Abraham circumcised his son as God had commanded. So in the time of great blessing, hopes and promises fulfilled, Abraham continues to obey God. He is not so overwhelmed or so focused on the blessing itself that he forgets what God has told him to do. So he names his son as God commanded, and at the time, 8 days later, that God had instructed, he circumcises his son. So here is faith in the midst of blessing, believing God in an obeying way. He obeyed God. And here is often what God is working toward in the midst of your blessings. He wants us to not forget him in the midst of his blessings. He is polishing our obedience in the good times. And this is not as odd as it might seem at first. Is it not easy for us when God is pleased to prosper us and bless us to forget what God has instructed us to do? isn't it easy to stray away, to wander off, to, in the midst of blessing, to forget God? We take such great pleasure in God's blessings that we forget that we are created in order to bring pleasure to God. Or if I may put it another way, we have been created to please Him. Yet, many of us slip and slide and drift in times of blessing. So in these times, in the midst of personal blessing, God is polishing up your obedience. Obey Him. Please Him. So here is God at work to polish Abraham's obedience, and we see in verses 5 through 7 that in the midst of personal blessing, we have Sarah's evident joy. God has made laughter for me. Everyone who hears will laugh over me. Who would have guessed that anyone would have said to Abraham, hey, guess what, Abraham? Sarah will nurse a child. Yet I have borne him a son in his old age. The great miracle brings both joy and maybe a little bit of possibly nervous laughter. Sometimes there are ordinary blessings. I'm sorry. Now she knows that the story will spread wide, and she is amazed and grateful over her miracle. And she knows that there are those who will hear, and most will laugh with joy, and maybe a few will laugh in derision. Sure, Sarah. God has been faithful so that she will bear a son in her old age. You see, God wants us to connect our blessings with His promises and His provisions. Sometimes there are ordinary blessings. Well, they just seem to be ours. Then there are those extraordinary blessings where we are acutely aware that they are from God. The polishing work God is doing in blessing is for us to see God at work, whether it's ordinary or extraordinary. He desires that our enjoyment of what He has blessed us with points others to God. See, that's the point here, isn't it? Who would have said? Everyone who hears. God is at work getting Sarah, in the midst of the enjoyment of her blessings, to say to others, this is from God. Bless God. So Abraham is being stretched and shaped to obey God in the midst of blessing, and Sarah is being shaped in such a way that her blessings cause her to point others to the God who blesses. So make no mistake, God is polishing you in the midst of your blessings. Will you forget Him? Or will your enjoyment of God's blessing help others to see God at work? So God is at work, is polishing you in the midst of personal blessing. God is also at work to polish you in the midst of family conflict. That's what we have in verses 8 through 21. God is preparing and polishing people when family relationships are in the midst of difficulty and division. They can be very painful. Issues between spouses, between parents and children, in extended families can be so disheartening and discouraging. Yet, God is at work. Look at verses 8 and 9. And the child grew and was weaned, and Abraham made a great feast on the day that Isaac was weaned, that Sarah saw the son of Hagar, the Egyptian, whom she had borne to Abraham, laughing. So here's this initial problem. What was a blessing now becomes a point of difficulty and division. It has been as much as 2 years between verses 7 and 8. Their culture, they tend to wean children between 18 months and 30 months was sort of a cultural thing. So with 2 years have passed now, Abraham is noticeably proud of his son When he cleans, he throws a big party. The family's all there, including Hagar and Ishmael. And the text here says that Ishmael was laughing, and presumably at Isaac. The laughter here is probably one of derision or scorn, and there's a little bit of a play here in Moses' writing on her joy and possibly his derision. Ishmael is not a kid. Here he's between 14 and 17 years old. Abraham was 86 when Ishmael was born, and he's 100 when Isaac was born, and we're 2 years possibly beyond that. So this is a teenager. And here is the elder son who is probably fully expects to be the heir and is making fun of this kid who's at the center of attention. And boy, look at the responses, verse 10 through 14. Sarah saw, and so she said, verse 9 to verse 10. So she said to Abraham, cast out this slave woman with her son for the son of this slave. She can't even bring herself to call her by name. For this slave woman shall not be heir with my son Isaac. And the thing was very displeasing to Abraham on account of his son. But God said to Abraham, be not displeased because of the boy and because of your slave woman. Whatever Sarah says to you, do as she tells you. For through Isaac shall your offspring be named, and I will make a nation of the son of the slave woman also, because he is your offspring. So Abraham rose early in the morning and took bread and a skin of water and gave it to Hagar, and putting it on her shoulder along with the child, and sent her away, and she departed and wandered in the wilderness of Beersheba. Now, Sarah is quite evidently very angry. Maybe she sees a heart trajectory that is putting Isaac in danger when she hears Ishmael laughing, particularly laughing in scorn and mockery. Maybe there's been this long, smoldering resentment in Sarah that now finally burst through. She's had it. This is the proverbial straw that breaks the camel's back. Now, and maybe Ishmael's laughter is just that of a happy young boy, and Sarah is misreading evil into it. We don't know. The Bible doesn't clear. Nevertheless, she's upset. Boy, how much family conflict happens like this? Something's misread. Long smoldering resentments. Maybe an actual insight into an evil heart trajectory. And there's war. Abraham is not happy. This is very difficult. He is in the middle of a mess, frankly, of his own making. There's been conflict between Hagar and Sarah, and now the boys are involved, and he loves Ishmael. Make no mistake. And now Sarah is making a demand that is very displeasing. He obviously is loath to send them away. He knows the last time they left, God sent them back with a tacit rebuke of Abraham and Sarah for their handling of it. Didn't work last time, why would we do it again? And it seems he's poised to reject Sarah's demands and try to weather the storm. I made that mistake last time, not making it again. And God intervenes. God is at work. God intervenes to show Abram that while this is very difficult, it is serving God's purposes and plans. God assures Abraham that he intends to bless Ishmael because of the promises to Abraham. He also makes clear that this is happening in order to protect Isaac's place in the family and his future inheritance. So Abraham gets up early the next morning, and he does so to obey God. He loads her up with provisions for the journey. He sends her on her way, and she ends up wandering around in the southern wilderness, which will later, in this chapter, be called Beersheba. This is tough. This is hard. so hard that God steps in and makes sure that in Abraham's obedience, what God is at work in the midst of this conflict to do actually happens. And here's Abraham's great heart, kindness and providing in the midst of this conflict. Then verses 15 through 21, in the midst of this conflict, we find God's divine providence, His provision. She departed and wandered in the wilderness of Beersheba, and when the water in the skin was gone, she put the child under one of the bushes. Then she went and sat down opposite him a good way off, about the distance of a bow shot, for she said, "Let me not look on the death of the child." And as she sat opposite him, she lifted up her voice and wept. God heard the voice of the boy, and the angel of God called to Hagar from heaven and said to her, "What troubles you, Hagar? Fear not, for God has heard the voice of the boy where he is. Up, lift up the boy, hold him fast with your hand, for I will take him. I will make him a great nation." Then God opened her eyes. She saw a well of water, and she went and filled the skin with water and gave the boy a drink. And God was with the boy, and he grew up. He lived in the wilderness and became an expert with the bow. And he lived in the wilderness of Paran, and his mother took a wife from the land of Egypt. Seems that Hagar has become lost and has run out of water. They have wandered around long enough now that Ishmael apparently has begun to fail and possibly is nearing death. She cannot bear to watch him die. So she lays him down under some bushes, gets a bow shot away, sits down, begins to cry for her loss. And for the second time in Hagar's life, God speaks to her. He will not allow them to die, for he has plans for them. How can he become a great nation if he dies here? And yes, they were an obstacle to Isaac being the sole heir, and they had to depart so that that thread of redemptive history could advance. But God also has a plan for Ishmael, and that plan will not be thwarted. God is going to make a great people group from him, just as he promised Abraham. So God opens her eyes to see what she was blind to, a well of water that was nearby. Then the story, after sort of running on for quite a bit, abruptly ends in two sentences. God is with Ishmael. God is tending his life with protection and provision because God has made a promise he will keep. And they settle in the wilderness with Ishmael becoming a master archer and marrying an Egyptian. Now what about this? What do we make of a story like this? God is clearly at work in the midst of this conflict. This is not just random acts of unkindness. First, God is at work to carry out his plans. Abraham and Sarah's struggle with Hagar and Ishmael has not stopped God, nor has it hindered him. His plans will be carried out. While we might not know exactly what God's plans for us are, we know that he will work them out even when we are struggling with conflict, with differences, and division. Now don't hear me to be saying that necessarily conflict, division, and differences are necessarily in and of themselves right. Even when they are sinful, God is still at work in his mysterious way to carry out what he intends to do. I think most of us would agree that what Sarah wants to do here is not right at one level. But God is at work. And in the midst of conflicts that you may be involved in, particularly family ones, God is working. And secondly, God is at work to protect his people. Isaac is the true heir and Ishmael is an obstacle. Remember the theme of the book of Genesis? There are advances and obstacles. Here is a great advance and the removal of an obstacle. God has made sure there's no questioning of Sarah's purity in chapter 20, and now make sure there's no questioning of Isaac's place. At the same time, he takes up and cares for Hagar and Ishmael, because God cares for the cast out, for the widow and the orphan. And thirdly, God is at work to mold and shape his people. Though through this, God is working on shaping and molding Abraham, Sarah, Hagar, and to some degree even Ishmael. The file and the rasp, the buffer and polish may not be pleasant, nor may it be smooth. But God is a master craftsman. He's not bungling along. What he has in his mind will emerge. His polishing work will produce Christ-likeness in the end. We ought to take great heart in this. Even in the midst of intense conflict, God is at work to further his purposes. He may be protecting you. He may be carrying out his promises in a totally unexpected way. He may be preparing you for something, and he is certainly, I assure you, polishing you so that you will be more like Jesus. So God is at work. God is at work in the midst of your blessings. God is at work in the midst of family conflicts. And then in verses 22 to the end of the chapter, God is at work in polishing Abraham in the testing of a strategic relationship. Kind of hang in there with me just a little bit, okay? God is also preparing and polishing his people in testing and shaping important relationships. Now, I want you to think about this carefully. God has been preparing and polishing Abraham to become the patriarch in the land. Isaac has arrived, and the promise of an heir has been fulfilled. Ishmael has departed, and a threat has been removed. Now, Abraham secures the final piece of the promised land, that southern wilderness area called Beersheba. And he begins to put down roots. Through most of the rest of Abraham's life, he will live in this area. So let's think about that. Verses 22 through 24, God tests our strategic relationships. He is polishing us and preparing us by lasting commitments. Look at this. It's that time. At what time? At the time that Abraham casts out, that Hagar and Ishmael leave, at that time, at the time that Isaac is being born and weaned, at that time Abimelech and Phicol, the commander of his army, come to Abraham. God is with you in all that you do. Now therefore swear to me, here by God, and that you will not deal falsely with me, or with my descendants, or with my posterity. But as I have dealt kindly with you, so you will deal with me and with the land where you have sojourned. And Abraham said, I will swear. Now here is a strategic relationship, the one between Abimelech and Abraham. And Abimelech is going to appear several times as we move forward. He's an important, a strategic relationship. And maybe at this point in Genesis you might not see it, but when you see him even affecting Isaac later on, it's going to be important. Now, understandably, Abimelech is concerned with Abraham's status in his land. Moses intends for us to notice the order of events that led up to this. Abimelech has opened up the land for Abraham to live in. Abraham now has a natural heir, which he didn't have at the time it was opened up. And he has sent his competitor away. So, he comes with both a peace offering and a show of force. You better believe he shows up with the commander of his army. He's making a statement. And he acknowledges what we often miss in the midst of God's providences. Again, Abimelech shows he's a man who fears God. He sees, he recognizes that God is with Abraham through all these things. So he wants assurances. And he wants assurances because of Abraham's earlier deceptions. I love this. Now swear to me that you will not deal falsely with me. Do you think Abraham's conscience was sort of pricked? He wants assurances because of Abraham's earlier deceptions that Abraham will keep his word and act with kindness and respect to Abimelech. And to Abraham's credit, he doesn't protest, he doesn't react, he doesn't respond. He just simply says, I recognize I've wronged you in the past, and I raise my right hand in our culture and says, I swear. This is my promise. So they enter into a covenant that secures what Abimelech gave, and it also holds Abraham, his descendants, to their word. This is going to become important in the conquest of the land. But that's another story for another day. Here, God is testing Abraham in the midst of a strategic relationship by his making lasting commitments. Again, hang in there just a minute. I want you to follow along. Secondly, he tests their strategic relationship by settling differences, verses 25 through 32. So they're sitting here, I swear that I will not deceive you, and, you know, we'll enter into this great commitment, this great relationship. However, when Abraham reproved Abimelech about a well of water that Abimelech's servants had seen, Abimelech said, I do not know who has done this thing. And you did not tell me, and I have not heard of it until today. So Abraham took sheep and oxen and gave them to Abimelech, and the two men made a covenant. And Abraham set 7 ewe lambs of the flock apart. Abimelech said to Abraham, what is the meaning of these 7 ewe lambs that you have set apart? And he said, these 7 lambs you will take from my hand, that this may be a witness for me that I dug this well. Therefore, that place was called Beersheba, because there both of them swore an oath. So they made a covenant at Beersheba. Then Abimelech and Phicol, the commander of his army, rose up and returned to the land of the Philistines. Well, so in the course of their discussion, Abraham complains to Abimelech that some of his servants had seized a well. These were wells that Abraham had dug. Now, in the Mideast, the digger of a well in open land owns the well itself until a formal agreement or treaty is reached with the local king or tribal chief. This is just culture. However, Abimelech's servants have seized the well without Abimelech's knowledge and evidently without going through what we would think of as due process. Abraham then offered 7 lambs to Abimelech. These are given as certifying that he had dug the wells. He is in essence acknowledging that he's been deceitful in the past, and he is swearing to the truthfulness of his claim. Abimelech enters into the covenant with Abraham, giving him these wells and affirming, in essence, Abraham's overlordship in the land. A part of this point of this is to show that Ishmael's descendants have no claim on this part of Philistia, called Beersheba. It would be easy for them to say, see, Ishmael lived in this land before Abraham settled in this land, so it ought to be our land. And it also undermines the claim the Philistines have. So they can come back to this and say, Abimelech, who was the overlord, gave us and all our descendants the right to this land. A strategic relationship based on important treaties, covenants, and promises. Abraham has duly asserted his claim. It has been affirmed. Beersheba will become an important homestead for the patriarchs right up to the time to go down to Egypt. In verses 33 through 34, God is polishing and preparing Abraham in the midst of testing strategic relationships by calling and causing Abraham to acknowledge God. Abraham planted a tamarisk tree in Beersheba and called there on the name of the Lord, the, maybe better, enduring God. And Abraham sojourned many days in the land of the Philistines. In 3 ways, Abraham acknowledges God in the midst of this strategic relationship. He plants a tree as a lasting memorial to this event. He identifies and worships God as the enduring one, and he lives in peace and safety in this area that was later inhabited by the terrible enemies of Israel, the Philistines. God is preparing and polishing Abraham to become rooted and to settle down the land. This is the beginning of the transition from being a sojourner to becoming settled. Through a time of blessing, he has his son. Through a time of conflict, God protects his heir. And through a time of testing this important relationship, God has caused him to put down roots, sort of figuratively in the tamarisk tree, and to trust and worship an enduring God. In the midst of enormous blessing and conflict and change and challenges and all of this, his God is an enduring God. Now, if we think about this for a moment, we can see the relevance of this for our lives. Most of us are involved in important relationships. Our primary one here is the church. But we have strategic relationships at work, at school, maybe in our neighborhoods. God is at work through them to place us where he wants us, to cause him to serve and witness for him, and to give opportunities to know his name and to trust him. So here's a strategic relationship, Abraham and Abimelech. And you have relationships like this. Many of you can think immediately and apply this directly to your work. Where God is at work, as he moves things around, and as those you work with and those you work under sometimes challenge you and sometimes correct you and sometimes make promises to you that they keep or they break. But in all of these strategic relationships, God's doing this. He's polishing. He's proving. He's shaping. He's testing. So here are some important lessons to hang our hats on. Recognize that God is causing you to learn to live as an Isaac and not an Ishmael. What? Recognize that God is causing you to learn to live as an Isaac and not an Ishmael. Why do I say that? Because in Galatians 3 and 4, Paul, writing to the church, alludes back to this casting out of Ishmael and teaches the Galatian Christians to stop living a certain way. He exhorts them to live as the new man you are becoming, not the old man, to walk in the Spirit, not in the flesh, to live in freedom, not bondage. All this because Ishmael, representing the old, the flesh, and bondage, was cast out. And Isaac, the son of promise, represents the new, the Lord Jesus Christ, and spirit, and freedom. So God is at work in polishing you to cause you to live like the Christian you ought to be. Not try to go back under the law. Not try to live in the power of the flesh, not to be in bondage, but rather to be like Isaac, set free, to be a son of promise, to live in the grace that God is giving, and to not try, as the Gentiles in Galatia were, to go back to circumcision-like stuff. So this is what God is polishing you. Paul is not, contrary to most of my commentators, bending a text to serve his purpose. No, he's going back and he is seeing God's purpose in that text. And that's why this sermon has been about polishing and preparing, when it probably wasn't obvious. Galatians tells us, don't live like this. Live like that. And in all of this, conflict, blessing, and relationships, God is causing you to not live in the old, but now to live in the new. Go look, read Galatians 3 and 4 this week. Secondly, God is at work in all of life to prepare you and polish you. Never forget it. It doesn't matter what's going on. Everything is designed by the loving hand of God to draw you to Him and to cause you to please Him. In God's world, there are no true accidents. Just unforeseen providences where God is carrying forward His plan and His purposes, and in all of them, be pleasing, be a delight, bring joy to His heart. Now, if you would call yourself an unbeliever or a seeker, I'd like to speak to you for a moment. God is not just at work in the lives of His people. He's brought you here this morning to meet this particular group of people, to sing these very songs we sung this morning, to hear this message from Genesis 21 preached on this day. It's no accident. So maybe today is the day to give your life to God, to believe in Him, to surrender to Him, to call on Him to save you. It may be that you are not ready yet. You've got doubts or questions or just not sure. You really don't know what all this is about, but it does capture your heart, your interest, your attention. We would be delighted to talk with you after the service. Recognize that God is causing you to learn to live, if I can put it this way, Christianly. God is at work in all of life to prepare you and to polish you. Please God when you are experiencing the blessing of God. And this is a bigger challenge than we sometimes want to acknowledge.